All right, good afternoon. So we are in Shmuel Aleph Perek Vav, chapter 6. And the Plishtim have returned to the Aron. It is on its way back. It is being led by, well, not led by anybody. It is being drawn by cows. Cows which have never drawn a wagon before, on a wagon which has never been used before. And the cows have their young. Sorry?
What difference does it make?
Right, so the wagon not having been used before, I think, is more a matter of sanctity. It's the idea that this isn't something that we, you know, it's a hand me down, so to speak, from something else.
The wagon doesn't know how to get from A to B, doesn't it?
Presumably. No, I think that there are things humans. Right. There are things that you could say regarding how wood is broken in and so on, but I don't think you need to. I think the answer is that it's, as you said, part of the gift. It's used with the Aron. It's not something that carried somebody else's, you know, comic books or whatever. It's
got a big journal.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was hoping for something other than garbage. So the cows bring it back, and we had this word Vayisharna, right, which we've now talked about, whether it means they went straight or they sang, the idea that going straight was the act of singing. But the Gemara here in Avodah Zarah, in source number 1 on your sheet, I cut off the beginning of it because that we already saw last time and I wanted to fit everything on one page. But the Gemara gave us multiple views of what their song was. Even though Maharal already told us that it wasn't a verbal song, even within his view of how to read this, there is something about their song that resonates with these psukim, with these sentences, and therefore he's saying, what was the message of their nonverbal song? But either way, whether I take it literally, they sang words and these are their words, or whether I take it as this was the message of their nonverbal song, what I want to do is go through these various options the Gemara gives. The first 5 of them are psukim, and then the last one is not. And ask the question of what we're meant to learn from this. Why is the Gemara going through a debate as to what song they sang? What am I supposed to get out of this? So correct. So their first approach is Rabbi Meir. Right? Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yochanan quotes Rabbi Meir saying, this week's parsha, Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael. I think we may have mentioned and explained this one already last time, that one relevant piece of this is that the song continues to say, Ashiru Lashem Ki Ga'oga, and the description of the cows lowing or mooing was Haloch V'Ga'o. Granted, it's pronounced differently, close enough that it's an association. Plus, of course, this is a song and this is a song. The Marsha adds that in Az Yashir, at one point, we say Chil Achaz Yoshvei Pleshet, that the dwellers of Pleshet, Plishtim in other words, trembled. So that's what happened here, right? The dwellers of Pleshet. Those were the people here who had their own trembling issue. And so that association fits. So there's a textual association, and there's also a thematic association here, which Maharal points out, which is that this is praise that God didn't abandon us after taking us out of Egypt. He didn't abandon us then when we went through the sea, and he didn't abandon us now in this with the Plishtim. So that's your first approach. Second, Rabbi Yochanan himself, because Rabbi Yochanan first quoted Rabbi Meir, then Rabbi Yochanan didei Omar. Ba'amartem bayom ha'hu, hodu l'Hashem kir'u b'shmo. And then the rest of the pasuk is important. Hodi'u ba'amim alilosav. You have to know regarding Gemara. Gemara will often quote part of a pasuk, but it's not the part that you actually need. The part you need, they just think you know. Because in general, you find this when you read Medrash, they just assume that everybody was fluent in Tanakh. And so they give you shorthand, and then you'll know the rest of it. So here it's the rest of the sentence that matters. That's why I added the Vegomer in brackets there. Hodiu ba'amim alilosav. The pasuk means, and you will say on that day, thank God, call in His name, declare among the nations His deeds. And in fact, if you go back to sentence 6 in chapter 6, the priests, speaking to the people and giving them this advice about how to restore the Aron, said, why should you harden or honor your heart, we talked about that, as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? So they retold Hashem's deeds, as a result of this story. So the Maharshna says maybe that's the connection, is that this is about speaking of God's deeds among the nations. Okay.
And also goes on to say, Shiraloz Amrloz Sikhupamloz.
Right, it's the whole theme of the of that chapter. Correct. Correct. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, also known as Reish Lakish, offers a third. Amar, he said, Mizmora Yasma. The song they sang was an orphan psalm. And orphan psalm, according to Rashi, means that there's no author listed in it. It's not one of those that says, let's say, a song of the sons of Korach or whatever. That's one explanation. Tosfot says it means because many of the chapters of Tehillim have a clear context to them. This is when they were dedicating the Beis Hamikdash, or designed for the dedication of the Beis Hamikdash. This one was when, you know, David escaped from Shaul, or whatever it is. And this one is an orphan psalm in the sense that it doesn't have any context given. The song just starts. There's no name, there's no story, there's no nothing. So that's why he calls it that. And what is it? It's Mizmor Shiru Lashem Shir Chadash Kinef La'os Asa Hoshia Lo Yimino Uzra Kodesho. A song, a psalm. They sing to God a new song. Because he has done wondrous things, his right hand, his holy arm, has redeemed. What's the association? So, the idea, as the Maharsha sees it, is part of it is in the sentence that you see here, and part of it is not. The part that you do see here is Hoshia lo yimino. His right arm is victorious for him. Right, that's the part at the end of the sentence there, and the idea is that after the fall of the nation in battle, one might think that God is not victorious, and now it's saying no. The cows are saying God is victorious in battle, and then the other association is actually from it's actually from further along in that chapter of Tehillim, because that chapter continues with Lifnei Hashem Kiva. Before God, you should sing before God because God is arriving. And it's the song they sing as they're bringing the ark. So that's the Maharsha's read. Then you get Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Hashem Malach Yergezu Amin. God is king. The nations should be in turmoil. What does that have to do with anything? So one way to take it, the Maharal's way, is that it's simply that God struck the nations, causing them to return the Aron. However, the Maharsha says much more here. And again, you don't get the whole song, so therefore you wouldn't get it just from Hashem Malach Yergezu Amin. But the rest of the Pasuk, Hashem Malach Yergezu Amin, how does that Pasuk continue? It's in Kabbalah Shabbos. Ooh, there you go. Yoshev, you looked it up. Yoshev Kruvim, that's what you should do. Yoshev Kruvim Tanud Haaretz, the one who dwells with the cherubs. Right? He is the one who will shake the land. Yoshev Kruvim, where are the Kruvim? On the Aron. Right? So God is the one who dwells with the Aron. That's the Maharsha's point. Then the next one, the last of the Psalms that's quoted, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni Amar, Hashem Malach Geut Lavesh. God is clothed in Geut, in majesty. So the Maharal says that's God demonstrating supremacy over Dagon, as the Dagon statue collapses. That's one explanation. There's an alternative chapter of Psalms that the Maharsha has in different editions. He has it as Psalm 97, which speaks about those who worship the idols being dismayed, a rejection of idolatry. And then the last one here. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha makes one up. He says it's not from Tehillim, it's not from Psalms at all. He says, here's what they sang. Roni, Roni, Hashita. Sing, sing, the shita. Shita is a kind of wood. I translate it here as acacia, or acacia, I don't actually know.
Acacia.
Okay. Because that's the way shitim are often translated, but the key is that the atzei shitim, that's the wood that's used to make the aron. The wood and the gold. Atzei shitim omdim.
I think also in the temple they use this.
Mm-hmm. They use it in the Mishkan as the walls. Yes. So so he says the acacia, this wood that's used to make the aron, should sing. His nofafi berov haderech, it should be elevated along the long road, Hamechusheket Berikmei Zahav. This one who is wrapped up in Rikmei Zahav, Rikmei embroidery of gold, and that's because the Aron has gold, it's wood and gold. Hamehulala bedvir armon. It is exalted in the Devir, or because of the Devir, meaning the Torah that's in it, in Hashem's palace, umufuara ba'adi adayim, and it is splendid in the crown of crowns. So the so Rav Yitzchak Nafcha says that that's what they sang. And there's another idea that he's talking about what the Jews sang in praise of the Torah when the Aron traveled in the Midbar. Fine. What we've now spent a lot of time on are 6 different explanations of what they sang. And I come back to the question that I started with. Why do they care? I mean, it's nice to know, but sorry? Well, again, it's either it's what the cows sing, or it's what the idea is that's meant to be conveyed by their following in Hashem's path. It's conveying the messages that these songs convey. In other words, it conveys God's triumph over idolatry, it conveys God's presence with the Aron, it conveys all of the different themes that we've identified here, conveys that the nations should speak of divine might. But what's the message?
We're sure it's not the Jews singing this.
Correct, 100%. 100%. So what's this about?
There's something miraculous going on.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that's being done is being done with a purpose.
Okay, so that everything here is driven by God. The so even the details of what they're going to sing. So the truth of the matter is, though, I would look at it and say, well, it's really a logical question, right? In other words, if God is going to decide to make them sing, the logical next question is, well, what are you going to have them sing? Right? It was this or Elvis, so you know he needed to come up with something.
But it's like Matovu.
Yeah.
It's like Bilam goes to curse them, and God makes him say nice things.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they really wanted to.
That was a donkey, though.
Well, whatever. Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah, you're right. Again.
But
here, maybe the cows would have normally on their own, or would have said something negative, and because God influenced them, or whatever the word is.
Wow.
Guide them.
So maybe the cows are still angry about the golden calf.
Well.
So I'd offer 2 other explanations. Number one is I wonder if this doesn't, except for Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha at the end, emphasize the divine role in creating Tehillim. In other words, Tehillim at this stage doesn't exist as a book, right? Some of the Tehillim are credited to authors who precede David. But David isn't on the scene yet. So this is saying all those songs that we associate with David and Tehillim, actually Hashem already created them before. They're from God. And that's one take. The problem that I have with it is, first of all, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha goes off entirely on his own. And number two, I don't know why you need this story in order to do that. So I would offer another idea that I think is more likely, which is part of our whole theme in this section has been, and really the entire first 6 chapters of the Sefer, but certainly the last couple of chapters, has been that we don't value the Aron. The Plishtim figure it out, right? They store it with their god, positive or negative. Their god collapses in front of it, right? They don't stop worshiping. They send the Aron back with all of the stuff and the gifts and everything else. Granted, it took some pushing, but there's an element of respect that comes from the Plishtim for their god and for the Aron. While the Jews left the Aron there for 7 months. Right, and didn't make any attempts. And again, we're going to see more about that as we go through the rest of this.
So the cows sing,
exactly.
Whereas the
right, the cows can sing to God.
Oh, nice.
We have issues. Mm-hmm. But the cows can do it. I wonder if that isn't what the Gemara is doing.
They're giving so much importance to it.
So I wonder if that's what's going on. Either way. Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. Right, we read it last time and started talking about it a little bit. The Jewish side of things. Uveit Shemesh, Kotzrim, Kitzir, Chitim, Ba'emek. The Jews of Beit Shemesh are harvesting here in the valley. They're harvesting the wheat. Life continues as normal. The Vayisu es Einehem, and they pick up their eyes. Vayiru es Ha'aron, and they saw the ark. Vayismechu Leros, and they're really happy. Right? They're happy to see it. So there are a couple of things that are odd in this sentence. Besides the harvesting. Forget the harvesting for the moment. What's interesting here?
They don't stand out and run and greet it. They just stop.
Like,
so that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's lots of panic. That's the impression that I got also.
Mm-hmm. Who's carrying it? It's just the cow bringing it like it's a car driving.
They're not a no
driver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's true. Look at 14. Look at Pasuk Yudalad. The wagon went to the field of Yehoshua Beit Shemesh, whoever he is. And it just stood there. And they're just watching. Hey, I wonder what's going to happen.
Nobody's running and dancing.
And
it's just over.
Right. So I think that's definitely part of it. What else?
Would they have known that this is the Aron? Would they have been able to recognize it?
Yes. It's the cherubs on top.
And are they comparing the joy of the cows and the Jews just
yeah. Right. No, I think that's true. Another piece of it, Vayisu einehem vayiru, is a phrase which shows up in the Torah quite a few times, either Vayisayna vayar or Vayisu einehem vayiru. So take a look. I gave you actually a list of times in Chumash where this shows up. The first one is Vayisa Einav Vayar. That is Avraham when the Malachim pass by. And the idea is that Avraham is sitting at the entrance of his tent. It's very hot out. He isn't expecting to see anybody. And then suddenly, lo and behold, three people right walking in the wilderness.
Another one would be the
nope, the Akedah is different wording.
The, Yitzhak and Rivka?
The second one is Yitzhak and Rivka. Sorry, in source number 2, I just gave you the references, I didn't bring you the psalm.
Ah, okay.
So the second one is Yitzhak when Rivka arrives. And again, he's walking, talking in some way in the field, and suddenly he picks up his eyes, and lo and behold, and there she is. The third one that I brought you on the sheet is from Perek Lamed Gimel in Bereishis, and that's when Yaakov sees Esau's 400 men. The next one is that same section, when Esau sees Yaakov's large family. The next one is Yosef's brothers who are ready to kill him or throw him in a pit, and then they see the merchants. And then the last one there that I brought there is when Yosef sees Binyamin. That they brought Binyamin down. There are others as you go further into Navi, but the Dat Mikra edition, I forget, this is Professor Elite Sur? I think this is Professor Elite Sur. I just wanted to check. No, it's not. It's Professor Kiel, Yehuda Kiel. He says, often, is when you see something unexpected. You didn't think that was coming. You weren't thinking about it. They had no thought about the Aron. The Aron was not on their mental horizon. Well, that's for sure.
Their eyes looking
exactly. It's not like they were out there thinking, when was the Aron coming back?
Yeah.
This was an entry of something new into their world. So what do? Well, the wagon comes to the field of this fellow Yehoshua in Beit Shemesh, who I know nothing about, where they had a large stone. So what did they do? They broke up the wagon, and the parot, the cows, they brought as a korban olah to Hashem.
They should have turned back.
Yeah, the poor cows. Realistically, you're a cow and you just sang Shira. Like, what else are you going to do after that anyway? You've hit your pinnacle. Like, what else can you do with this? There is no second act.
Or maybe
now they're going to retire.
So
they bring the cows as carbonos. But this is actually really interesting. You're allowed to do this, meaning that once Shiloh is destroyed, they're allowed to have private altars and private offerings. So that in of itself is okay. However, there are some quirks to this. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, source number 3, notes that we have a problem. And I don't want to discuss the problem in depth because it's a little bit delicate. But basically, the rule is that a non-Jew, that when a non-Jew brings a korban, because a non-Jew is allowed to bring a korban to God, but they have to use our animals. They can't bring their own animal. It has to do with how the animal may have been used beforehand. So the
virgin cows.
So how does who know what?
In other words, Bnei Yisrael, she says something about it being that these were unused, but Bnei Yisrael knew nothing about that because there was nobody guiding these cows.
Correct. But the rule is you can't, right, the cows have to be ours. In general, when people bring carbonos, you should just know the way carbonos work is it was rare, unless it was a firstborn animal, it was rare that you were bringing your own animal. The firstborn, that's the animal you bring. But otherwise, generally speaking, you brought your money to the Beis HaMikdash. They had somebody there with chips, and you would buy a chip that was appropriate for the kind of korban you were getting. Then you took your chip to the person who was in charge of the animals, traded in, and you got the animal. Because think about it. All these rules about the eligibility of an animal, issues of blemishes and what it's been used for, and not to mention the fear. If I dedicate my animal at home, and then I have to make sure it's not going to get blemished or whatever along the way, it's a lot easier to just go there with my money, pay the money, get the animal, and bring the korban. So that's the way that that it tended to be done. So Jew or non-Jew, they would tend not to bring their own animals. But the issue, if you believed in God or God as one of many gods, remember that they, you know, there were plenty of polytheistic religions out there. So the point is, though, you're not supposed to use his animal. How did they do it here? The Gemara asks. That's source number 3. It says they brought these. The Gemara had stated the rule that you're not supposed to use their animals, and it asks, but here they did. So the Gemara's answer is haras sha'a paisa. It was special temporary dispensation. This was a unique situation. Now, it's important to understand what haras sha'a means, because it comes up a lot. Haras sha'a means not just this weird thing happened, it's inconsistent with halacha, it must be that someone decided to do it at that point, then they had authority to be able to do it. A Navi said you could do it. But that's not the underlying principle. The underlying principle of haras sha'a is there was a need. There was a reason to go around the usual rules in this particular case. So yes, there's a rabbinic rule, we don't use their animals, but in this case, there was a special need. What was the need? So take a look at Rashi. Haras Shah, and still in source number 3. He says, Haras Shah mipnei nes shenasa al yedehen, because of the miracle that had been performed. Sheviu ha'aron me'atzma, that the cows brought the aron back themselves. Ve'ein ish manigam, no one's leading them. Ves b'nem kalu b'bayis, v'lo go'ach b'nem, and the kids were all locked up. How the Jews would know that, we'll see in a moment. Elichu ela halichu, just the cow just brought it. V'amru shira, and they sang, kidla kaman, as the Gemara that we've already seen says. So Rashi says, the motivation driving this was to respond to the miracle. We need to do something to respond to the Aron being brought back like this. Here's how we are going to respond to it. And that's the Gemara's answer. And then the Gemara continues to say, still in source number 3, Hachinami Mistabra, it makes sense to say that this was Haras Shar, the Shah, that this was a special dispensation. Deilote Mahachi, because if you're not going to say that, Ola Nekeva Mi'ika, they brought it as an Ola. An Ola is a burnt offering. And the rule is, all the cases of burnt offerings that the Torah prescribes are always male animals. There are certain karbanos that are this animal, certain karbanos that are that animal, some of them are a goat, some of them are a lamb, whatever it is. The burnt offering is a male animal, traditionally. So the fact that they brought these as a burnt offering was also something that was unusual. The answer is they did it because they wanted to thank God for the miracle.
Their version of a Shira.
Yeah. Essentially.
And whose brilliant idea was this? I mean,
the Jews were there, Yehoshua Beit Shemesh, maybe.
That's what I'm saying, because there's no one, maybe that's why we know they had a meeting, they talked about it.
We know zero about it.
And they just all agreed for once.
Yeah, for once. They didn't die for it either. Yeah. They, yet. They, but how would they have known about the miracles? So go back to what we said earlier. Exactly. Pasuk Tetzayin, sentence 16, it's actually after this, fine. But we saw it last time. That the Plishti officers are there. But not only are they there, another answer for how they could have done this. Take a look at source number 4, which is the Yerushalmi's version of this discussion. The Yerushalmi asks the same question. You tell me that we can't use the animals they bring, but the text says, Anshei Beit Shemesh halu olav vayiz b'chuz vachim l'Hashem. They brought these animals as korbanos. To which the Yerushalmi answers, V'chi misarnei plishtim anu l'meidin. Are you going to learn the halacha from the Philistine leaders? Which makes it sound like we weren't the ones who brought it. The Plishti leaders were the ones who brought it. They saw what had happened, and they actually brought the carbon. The Pnei Moshe, which I brought you, his commentary, he disagrees.
But it says Anshei Beit Shemesh. It says specifically Anshei Beit Shemesh Ha'elu Olav.
Right. So the Pnei Moshe says it means that the Plishti leaders were there, and that the Haras Shah was, we wanted to do this with those leaders. You're not going to get them to stick around. We're at war with them. No, it sure sounds like it. Yes, and that's why the Pnei Moshe says what he does, that we brought it with them present. But then the Haras Shah is not just we want to celebrate the miracle, but we want to do it in front of the Plishti officers. So those are the animals on scene that we're gonna use is the ones that brought it back. Okay, so the Aron is now back, enjoy it while it lasts. Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17, I don't remember whether I called your attention to this before, but if you're using a sefer that tracks the way that it's written in a parchment edition, a cloth edition of Shmuel, there are gaps in sentence 17.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a gap. Asham Lashem, a gift for God. Ashdod 1. Aza 1. Ashkelon 1. Gat 1. Ekron 1. This is a Shira, right? It's a song to God. I actually saw an academic paper that said its ancient style was to do lists like this, and then you have a summary at the end, because in sentence 18 it tells us that there were, again, according to the number of the cities and all of that. But it's a song. That's what it's doing. It even has a nice catchy rhythm to it. No, they're not part of the carbon. This is the gift that the Plishtim sent.
Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
In Numbers 16,
hold on. Yeah.
It says, "Hamisha sarnei plishtim ra'u v'yashuvu ekron b'yom ha'u."
Yeah.
Five leaders of the Plishtim.
Yes.
Went back.
Yep.
That means that they were maybe following the
yeah, no, we said they were. Yeah, we had said that.
Okay.
Yes.
So then, the one you're saying about Ve'ele Teorea Zahav, it's for the five cities of Plishtim.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that means maybe that the leaders were one from each city.
Oh, yes. No, they were.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
But then they've gone away.
They left after this.
So they didn't do it in time.
No. The idea is that they left at this point. In other words, you brought it. You brought the carbon in sentence 15. And then in sentence 16, they left. Exactly. But yes, it's one per city in terms of the leaders and in terms of these tchorim that are brought. Ricky?
I don't understand this. And also, they actually use the word Echore.
Yeah, they've been using that a lot. Mm-hmm. It was only in the beginning that we had the Apol written. Sentence 17 is just enumerating one per city in this.
So they're talking about the Plishtim here.
No, they're talking about the Tchorim.
That came from these cities.
Yes. From these five cities. Oh, we didn't read it? Oh, okay. So that's my fault. So here are, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Here are the tchorim, the gold tchorim that the Plishtim returned as a gift to God. We talked about them sending a gift, that we did. We said, L'Ashdod Echad, Ashdod, and there are five Plishti cities, five central cities. Ashdod is one, Aza is the second one, Ashkelon the third one, Gad is the fourth one, and Ekron is the fifth one. So it lists
from those cities that they
yes. Yeah. And then that's the Tchorim. And then you have the Achbarim, right? Don't forget the gold mace. Bereya Zahav, and that is Mispar Kol Arei Plishtim. That was not based on the five, but all Plishti cities. Lachameshet Hasranim were brought by the five leaders. Meir Mivtzar Bad Kofar HaPrazi. Whether you were talking about a fortress, or whether you were talking about some open, unwalled village. Every Plishti town sent a mouse. Ve'ad Avel HaGedolah, to Avel HaGedolah, which we generally assume is that great big stone in Beit Shemesh, in the field, Asherinichu Ala Ezaron Hashem, where they put the Ark of God, Ad Ayom Hazeh, to this very day, and as always with this very day, unclear what this day is, Bisdei Yehoshua Beit HaShimshi, it's located in the field of Yehoshua of Beit Shemesh. So one thing here that I noted originally a couple of weeks ago, but now we're seeing it come to fruition, was the instructions they received were one gold mouse, one gold tchor per city. But when it came to the mice, they actually did one per town. So Barbanel comments on that in source number 5. He says, he says, granted that the sorcerers and the priests only told them to bring five gold mice for five leaders of the Plishtim, the people clearly didn't want to do that. They said, they said, if we're going to have one gold ofel for each of the leaders, so the ofel, same thing as the tchor, as we've discussed, so too, we're going to send a gold mouse for every town, every village. They're in a panic. You tell us to send just, you know, one gold thing per capital cities, maybe the capital cities are going to be fine, but the towns are going to be in trouble. Right? We're all sending gold mice. There's a lot of gold mice. They left it out in the field of Yehoshua of Beit Shemesh. It's no wonder that Ayom HaZeh doesn't really mean Ayom HaZeh. Somebody came along and found the gold mice.
And whenever they this was legal,
who gets to keep all that gold?
They're leaving now.
If Ashdod, Gaza, and Ashkelon, the cities that we have today, they were just fishy territory then and now they're...
They still are.
What?
Meaning that area is the area that is today Gaza.
Yeah.
So... I mean, whether it's the same spot or whether it's a kilometer over or whatever, because cities over time are destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt. But yes, that's that area where today you have Ashkelon and Gaza and Gaza and all that. That's the spot. Yeah.
Quite a long way to get to it.
It sits out in the field of Yehoshua Beit Shemesh when somebody comes along and says, "Hey, gold mice." No, no, seriousness.
What are you doing?
I mean, how many gold mice can you really keep in your house?
The leadership
will do. Yeah. We need to do great things. What are we going to do?
It was meant for Hashem. Yeah. It was meant as a tribute to Hashem, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Do something with the gold mice. Okay. Yeah. For sure. Cue exactly the word that comes to mind. Okay. So let's see the fallout. Let's see what happens now, because this is going to, what we're going to see now is going to conclude the whole polemic. This whole thing, the theme that we've developed here of the Jews' relationship with the Mishkan and the lack of respect, which really goes back to the beginning of the book and the people not going to the Mishkan and how, you know, Chana and Elkanah are pioneers in this sense of going to the Mishkan, and Hophni and Pinchas and their abuse of the Mishkan, and then continuing with the Plishtim taking the Aron, not taking the Aron out to war, the whole bit, that whole theme of lack of respect for God and the Aron comes to its culmination in this next short section here. It's going to be Pasuk Yotet, running through the first Pasuk of Perek Zion. Sentence 19. Vayach ba'anshei Beit Shemesh. He struck. He can only be God. He struck the people of Beit Shemesh. Ki ra'u ba'aron Hashem. Because they saw, now you remember that word, vayismechu lirot, their Abi to see, because they had looked ba'aron Hashem at the Ark of God, vayach ba'am shivim ish, chamishim elef ish. Now here we need your translations. Those words, vayach ba'am shivim ish, chamishim elef ish. Who has the 70 men, 50,000 men. Is that how all your translations do it?
Yeah.
Okay. That number makes no sense. For two reasons. Why does that number make no sense?
Because it probably were 50,000 men in the church, I imagine.
That's what you said. There weren't. So first of all, Linda points out, 50,000 is a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, go back to Shoftim, and there were whole Shvatim that didn't have 50,000. Now, suddenly, you have 50,000 people in Beit Shemesh. I mean, Beit Shemesh today. You know, 50,000 is a very large number. And now, I mean, how many people were even there when they found the... Like, what are you talking about? That's number one. Well, it sounds like it's Anshei Beit Shemesh we're talking about. But you're right. That's one problem. And then the other problem is right, how do you count... How do you present numbers?
That's what Ricky was asking.
70 men, 50,000 men, and is a multiple choice. Like what? I don't even understand what it means.
Maybe 70 men.
Yes, Diane.
So there's a translation here.
Yes.
One's from the Targum, which says 70 elders and 50,000.
We're getting to that.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. Okay, it's there. The so 70, 50,000, we need to know what that's about. The people are grieving. Because there's been this great blow against the people. And the people of Beit Shemesh said, who can stand before this great God? One of the commentators notes on this lamod, I think it's Radak, is lamod l'sharet, to stand and serve. Who is going to be able to take care of the Aron, to do proper honor to it? And who can we get to take it? Right? We can't keep it, so where's it going to go? And they already burned through all the cities of the Plishtim, so you know, none of them are taking it back.
They also need a wagon that's going to carry it.
Not to mention, we need a wagon.
Vayishlechu
malachim al yoshvei kiryat ya'arim. So they sent messengers. Malachim just means messengers. Don't get excited. It doesn't mean angels. To the residents of Kiryat ya'arim, lemor, with the following message. Heshiva Plishtim is Aron Hashem. Great news. The Plishtim sent back the Aron. Redu ha'aluos aleichem. You should take it up to yourself. This is like the old cereal commercial, right? Mikey likes it, right? So let's just tell him the Aron was sent back. Great news. Go ahead, take the Aron.
Well, let's come back.
When we go back to, where was it? It was originally in Shiloh, right?
Shiloh's gone. Shiloh's been destroyed.
Where was it? So
it was in Shiloh, but Shiloh was destroyed in the war.
So they can't take it back. So it sounds like they're
so there really has no place for the Aron to go?
It sounds very Plishtim.
Well, it sounds like that's what the Plishtim did. They said,
let's head to the city. So what? But look what happens. Kiryat Yarim. The people of Kiryat Yarim came to take it. Look at that. No delivery charge. They brought the Aron up. They brought it to the house of Avinadab in Giv'ah. And they consecrated his son Elazar to guard the Aron. Who are Avinadab and Elazar? That's part of what we have to talk about. There's a whole lot here that is very difficult to understand. What else is strange here?
How did they choose the
We have a first problem. Before you get to all of that, why did this happen to Beit Shemesh?
Exactly. They saw the Aron, right?
Mm-hmm.
And normally it's in the Mishkan and they can't see it, but when they take it to war, doesn't everyone see it?
They're not supposed to take it to war, right? That was a bad decision.
Didn't they use it anymore? No?
No.
I have a problem with Beit Shemesh.
Yeah, they have
it's not nowhere near any of the Plishtim towns.
So there are multiple places called Beit Shemesh. You have to remember, the name Beit Shemesh is quite possibly a Canaanite name, not even one of ours, and it was the place where they worshipped the sun.
So it's not the Beit Shemesh.
But not the Beit Shemesh.
So in the same way that we have multiple places that are called Beit El, the Beit Shemesh could, well, there could be multiple Beit Shemesh places. The
so we don't know how far they went. So
no.
So why are they blamed? The rest of the nations are blamed.
Right. Just because they got lucky.
No, so when where were they supposed to take it?
Well, they afraid.
We don't know.
Were they still afraid that the Jews were, because of look what did to the police team?
Well, they're clearly afraid because they got 50,000 dead people. That's a reason to be afraid.
You mean the police?
No, the Jews.
The Jews.
Well, so let's take a look at your sheet at number 6. Ralbach, bottom of one side, top of the second side is the English. Ralbach says, Lahodia, remember Ralbach, at the end of each section, as he defines a section, he gives you a whole bunch of lessons that you can learn. So this is lesson number 30 from the previous unit. Lahodia based Yisrael, the purpose here is to teach the Jews, Asher ba'avuro nischayvu sheyiblu biyad plishtim. He says the point is to teach them that because of this, what this is we have to see, they fell to the Plishtim. The Plishtim recognized who God is. Amru, they said, they said, who's going to save us from this great God? When they got the Aron, they took the hint right away. 7 months, fine. And they sent it with honors. The Jews are worshipping idols. You want to know what they were doing for 7 months? They worshipped Avodah Zarah. And they didn't learn from what had happened to them. In other words, what they endure here is, again, a function of lack of honor for the Aron and a lack of loyalty to God. That's the way Ralbag sees what happens. But we need to understand what this business is of the 50,000 and the 7th, and the 70 and the 50,000. So the Gemara in Sota offers two explanations. Take a look at number 7. Vayach ba'am shivim ish chamishim elef ish. That was what we said in the pasuk. Rabbi Avo and Rabbi Elazar, two different views. Rabbi Avo and Rabbi Elazar debated. Chad amar shivim ish hayu. One said 70 people died. V'chol echad ve'echad shakul k'chamishim elef. But each one was like 50,000.
Right.
Right. So why that number? That's a little weird. It's not a number that we have any association with elsewhere. There is no, 50,000 somewhere else.
And usually it's, somebody who's maybe well-known or has a great stature that could be worth more than just him.
Right, you think of the war with Ai, where it said that about 36 were struck, so he said it was one person who was the equal of half of the Sanhedrin, right? It was one of the answers that we gave. Exactly. There should be something to the number and something to the identity. This is hard to sustain. What they're dealing with is the problem. We don't have 50,000 people there, and the fact that it's written oddly. Hold on, Diane, one second. V'chad Amar, and the other one said, Chamishim Elef Hayu. No, it's 50,000. V'chol Echad V'Echad Shakul K'Shivim Sanhedrin. Number 70, that's a number we know. There are 70 judges on the Sanhedrin. 70, 71, we'll give it. But it was 50,000 people, each one the equal of the Sanhedrin. The problem is, so what do I do with the 50,000? That's just such a ridiculous number.
With Sanhedrin.
You have Moshe picked 70 elders back in the Midbar, in the wilderness. Yeah. Sorry?
No, I was just thinking, you said we don't have that number. We have that in the Haggadah, though.
50,000.
Yeah,
but we don't have any number 50,000. What we have there is just multiplying the...
Random. No?
It's not. No, it's calculated. Meaning it's Etzba Elokim Hi, this is the finger of God, and then it says he's the Yad Hashem, so you multiply it by 5 to get the hand. And then you have in the description of Amakos in Tehillim the different phases or types of anger that are displayed, reflecting the different kinds of Makos, the different severities of the Makos that strike the people, so you multiply it by the 4 or 5 different levels. Yeah. If you want, I can send you a link. I did a share on the math. Alina was there. She liked
it. And I actually get that every year. Like in a part.
What do we do with the odd, absurd amount? So, Professor Amos Chacham is quoted in a footnote in the Dan Mikra with an idea which comes up a lot in other contexts, which is the word Eleph may be mistranslated. This is a controversial idea, but I'm mentioning it. And that is, we have the word Aluf, which means the head of a clan. And that maybe came up, right, it came up in this morning share, which you were at. Which says, Eleph is Aluf, meaning it's a family. And that's what's actually being said, not 50,000, but 50 families. It's a little weird, a little hard, but the idea exists. It's used in general when people don't accept the idea that we were that large in the Midbar. So they say, well, the LS that you see are families, not thousands. Accept it or don't. Abarbanel, though, says we're reading the story wrong. He says, this is a summary line. The Aron is now back. And what we're doing is giving the whole death toll related to the Aron, going back to the initial war in which it was lost. That's the Abarbanel. So take a look at source number 8. He says, V'anachon etzli, what appears right to me, is, Shalom meisu v'anshei Beit Shemesh kim shivim mishlevad. 70 people died in Beit Shemesh. V'ayom misasam l'chol achas me'asibot hanizkarot, for the reasons that were already mentioned, im she'lo levad dibru shalom kahogen neged ha'aron. We're going to talk about the reasons. I'm not ready to talk about the reasons, so I'm going to skip that part for the moment. Jump to his second paragraph. V'amnam ha'chamishim elef ish shezachar, but the 50,000 who are mentioned, hu misparha harugim asher meisu besibas ha'aron. That's how many people died because of the way they dealt with the Aron. Im b'arei ha'plishtim, whether among the plishtim, v'im b'beit shemesh, or in Beit Shemesh, shayu kulam chamishim elef ish, all together it's 50,000. And why does the text say this? Here, bless you. Lefisha Ishlim Baze Sipur Inyana Plishtim Ubias Ha'aron. Because now we are completing the whole arc, so to speak. The whole issue with the Plishtim, I didn't do it on purpose. And the Aron's return, the Ishlim Lahodia Plaos Ha'aron Vahola Mesim Shemesu Besibaso. So we're recapping the wonders of the Aron as well as the death toll related to it. That's Abarbanel's way of addressing this problem. But now we have to talk about why. So what's the cause for the death toll? So the general approach is what I've been saying for a while, which is treating the Aron with disrespect. Right? And it seems to be related to Vayir'u. Right, v'yismechu lirot. They were happy to see it back in sentence 13, and then here again, they saw it. Radak says that they actually uncovered it. That's Radak's view. He said they actually uncovered it. And you're not allowed to do that. Remember that the Torah says, when it describes how the Levim have to safeguard all the things inside the Mishkan when they travel, v'lo yavol liroz kevalaz hakodesh v'meisu, they should not come see when it's being covered up, and if they do, they will die. So that's Radak's view.
Why are they uncovering it to make sure it's the Aron? How do they know it's the Aron?
Right. Yeah. So the question is, what does uncovered mean? Does it mean they took the lid off?
Oh.
Yeah. Remember, we don't know if the luchos are still there or not. We don't know if Shaul had taken them.
They don't know that.
Right. Well, I don't know what they know.
Is it wrong to check? Say that.
Apparently.
But nobody was supposed to touch the Aron.
But maybe it's a fake Aron.
Maybe they want to just check to make sure it's the real thing. Yeah.
The Malbim offers another take. Take a look at source number 9, please. The Malbim says, Kira'u ba'aron Hashem, ri'iyosh acharav bet. He says, when you have the verb to see, and then the next word starts with the letter bet, to see into something, more al hasagasa, v'hafla'a b'davar, v'hahaskala b'mahuto. He says, that indicates more than just seeing. It is perception, it is clarity, it is looking at its very essence. In other words, what they're doing here is not just the Aron, let me just look at it and make sure it's okay. it's actually really looking it over, staring at it, that's disrespectful. Like the he's showing you this from the grammar perspective, when Hashem sees our suffering in Egypt, which means more than just seeing, it's comprehension, Vayar be sivlosam. Ubalarov al inyanim hegyonim. It usually refers to abstractions, to perceiving, to understanding a concept. Ve'al ereh b'ra'asi. So Moshe says, I don't want to see the evil that's going to befall me. Ereh b'. Re'eh b'tuv Yerushalayim. See the good of Yerushalayim. It's something that's abstract. It doesn't mean to see something specific. Rotzelomar she'bitu bo yosim in hara'uy mimi'ut ha'yirav ha'kavod. They looked more than was appropriate, demonstrating a lack of awe, a lack of respect. So that's one idea. But the Gemara goes further and says it's more than seeing. If you take a look at source number 10, the Gemara in Sota, Vayach banshe beishemesh ki ra'u ba'oron, mishum de ra'u vayach, the Gemara asks, what, just for seeing? Therefore they should be struck? Rabbi Avo and Rabbi Elazar have a debate, the same debate that you saw back in number 7, they're discussing this story and commenting on the story. So Rabbi Avo and Rabbi Elazar debated. Chad amar kotsrin u'mishtachavim hayu. One says, they kept right on harvesting. They bow to the Aaron and they harvest, and they bow to the Aaron and they harvest. They're not letting up in the wheat harvest. V'chad omar, mili nami amur. And some said no, they actually spoke disrespectfully, and this was what Abarbanel noted back in number 8, saying, man amrich de imrias, uman asa alach de ephesis. Who made you bitter, such that you became bitter, meaning you left us, you abandoned us? And now, what's made you come back? In other words, it's more than just seeing, but they actually addressed the Aaron in this rude and even blasphemous way. So one school of thought is you treated the Aaron with disrespect on its return, looking too much, addressing it in a certain way. That's one take. But then Abarbanel has a second take, in which again he rewrites the structure of the story. And I'm going to say it outside of the text, because it's sort of, I didn't bring the whole thing in number 8, but Abarbanel suggests we're reading the story in the wrong order, because we're reading it in a linear way based on the way it's written in the text, and you know that's what we tend to do. But he says that's not the way it worked. Rather, the people of Beit Shemesh had the Aaron. They were afraid of having the Aaron, and they looked for somebody else to take it. They didn't want the Aaron. They moved the Aaron to Kiryat Yearim. After they moved the Aaron to Kiryat Yearim, they suffered a plague. Beit Shemesh suffered a plague of 70 people.
That makes sense.
Right. The way he reads it, go back to the psukim.
Is that for not keeping the Aaron?
It's for not keeping the Aaron, precisely. If you take a look at the psukim, the way to read it is this. Go back to sentence 18, gave us the return of the Aaron and the gold and all of that, right? Then in 19, we are told about death tolls because this is concluding the story. So we find out there's going to be a death toll for the people of Beit Shemesh and the Plishtim and everybody else. And that sentence 19 is a summary sentence. However, sentence 20 actually happened first. He says the people of Beit Shemesh said, we can't bear it, we're going to be in trouble. They sent to Kiryat Yearim saying, you take it. Kiryat Yearim takes it in chapter 7, sentence 1. And that's when they actually got struck. And what he solves by saying this is he explains why Kiryat Yearim took the Aaron.
Right.
If you had a plague, remember we asked for the Plishtim, why in the world did they accept it? So among the Jews, why did they accept it? Why is anybody taking the Aaron? The answer is, and here, they even accept it gladly. They went to pick it up. Right, it's not like with the Plishtim where they just shipped it. He suggests that that's because the plague hadn't actually happened yet, and what they're being punished for is for offloading the Aaron, not for looking at it.
Did the people of Kiryat Yearim get punished?
No, because they just accepted. They held it.
Right. Why did they want it?
Nice. So we're going to talk about that. I think it might be next time. But one more idea here. I wonder what role there is here for the way they treated it beforehand. the fact that they took it to war as this kind of totem, right? Mm-hmm. Here's something that's, you know, you're not supposed to take it to war. It was mistreatment then, and then they didn't look for it. How much of the punishment is that? Because they didn't, take care of the arm properly when they had it, and because they didn't come after it, I wonder if that isn't a piece as well.
Well, the punishment, didn't they lose the battle?
Yeah.
Well, so
losing the battle took care of it? Maybe. I mean, this is just a question in my mind about it.
I mean, you look at the juxtaposition of how the Israel reacted as opposed to how Amy acted. Like the grief, absolute grief that Amy felt that he died, from the knowledge that it was gone.
Well, he fell over the ground. That's how he died.
Yeah. But his reaction, caused it, as opposed to this, where it was like, yes, they had the war, they lost the war. But they had a chance after that to say, look at the terrible thing, we've lost the war, but even more important, we've lost the power that we should go after.
I mean, one thing that I think is missing in the discussion we've been having, because I haven't really presented it along these lines, is to ask the question for ourselves. Meaning, this isn't just something that happened historically, right? When we have opportunities to recognize Kedusha, what are we doing? You know, are we any better than the people who did nothing about the Aron? Right? I mean, you can talk about having Eretz Yisrael back, and you can talk about all sorts of elements that come with that. I think it fits.
I mean, there was nowhere where the Aron belonged. Where was it supposed to go now?
There is no place.
Could the town just keep it? I mean, it didn't belong to the people in Bet Shemesh either, did it?
No, it stays in Kiryat Yearim. That's where it stays.
No, but that's because they sent it. Is that where it's supposed to be?
There is no supposed to be. What we're going to talk about at the beginning next time is why Kiryat Yearim and what is special about Kiryat Yearim, because there is something that's special about Kiryat Yearim. So we're not there yet because we're running out of time. But God willing, in the beginning next time, we'll do that.
Hashem said to Beit Shemesh, in other words, the animals miraculously came to Beit Shemesh.
Well, that may be the closest
the
town, for all we know.
But the people did certainly have something to hold on, to say.
Say it should be here.
It should be here.
They didn't react well. Yeah, correct. All right, so God willing, we'll continue with this next time. But someone sent me an article just a few days ago, and it fit in perfectly, so I put it in here in number 12. I didn't give you the full article. I just gave you a small piece of it. This Times of Israel. Click the link on the email version of this. This is fascinating. They have discovered, and I'll mention it again next time, but they discovered a shrine to the Aron, monster-sized shrine in Kiryat Yearim.
Really?
So take a look at the article. So look in the article, they'll tell you. I don't remember. It's in Binyamin. That I will tell you. We'll talk more about where it is, because it's going to matter next time. Thank you very much.